Welcome to the Never Settle podcast. My name is Mel Clark, and I am passionate about helping people realise that settling for second best is no longer an option, and that everyone deserves to live the life they truly desire. So wow is all I can say for today's guest, the wonderful Rob Dubin. Rob is just the absolute epitome of Mr. Positive, happiness. He believes everybody's entitled to happiness, which of course they are. And he's led a pretty much charmed life. He had his own company, traveling the world, working for Fortune 500 companies with his camera in his hand, very much from Colorado, very much into filming the landscapes and nature, etc. And has just gone with his gut in terms of if he's not feeling happy anymore, then he changes. But went through a very life-changing event with his wife. They got caught in a blizzard for 5 days with some other people, and everybody thought they were dead. And they weren't, and you'll hear the story unfold, and it's just truly unbelievable, and really shows the power of how you think about what's happening rather than what's happening, because we can all put our own spin on an event that's happened, but it's how we actually think about it and remember it that will make the difference massively to whether that's going to be a positive experience or a negative one. And Rob absolutely shows this like time and time again in his life. And he went traveling on a sailing boat with his wife for 17 years. And has since decided he wants to give back and is now an inspirational coach, speaker, and very much interested in helping companies that are dealing with the great resignation after COVID. So yeah, I was really inspired with this conversation. I know you guys will be as well. So whether you're taking a walk or in the car or sitting down with a cuppa, enjoy. Well, hello, lovely listeners. Today, I have got the honour of speaking to Rob. Is it Dubin or Dubin? How do you pronounce it?
Dubin.
Dubin. Rob's in Colorado, and I've just been refreshing myself again with his bio before we jumped onto this. Wow, is all I can say. So, by his mid-20s, he was already an award-winning filmmaker, owned his own company, very well paid to travel the world, camera in hand, and working for numerous Fortune 500 companies. Sounds amazing, Rob. But after being lost in a winter blizzard in Colorado for 5 days, I'm intrigued to hear about that. Your wife and you were basically given up for dead, and the search had been viral worldwide. And so when you did survive, the first call you received was from the President of the United States. Which president was it?
It was Bill Clinton at that point.
Right, okay. But unfortunately, your wife suffered severe frostbite, and the doctors basically said they just wanted to amputate her feet and most of her fingers, which I don't blame you for saying, I don't think so. And you refused, and basically you both focused on getting her better. And it worked. And it sounds like you are a big Tony Robbins fan, because you used his studies to help you build that compelling future that you both wanted to work towards. So amazing. And then literally from there, you decided to sell your house, buy a sailboat, and then for 17 years, sailed around the world studying human happiness and fulfillment. There ain't many people that can say that, Rob. And you say you shared your lives with both billionaires and barefoot villagers in 100 countries. Very inspiring. And it was your own, the survival experience was your own personal COVID moment and your response to deciding to actually seek happiness that parallels what so many in the workplace are experiencing now, that great resignation that people realize is more to life than just the crap job they're in, right? So you are very much similar to me. You are now teaching people a recipe for happiness and to not settle with the careers that they're in, to have a more fulfilling career and a happier home life. And also to help corporations, and again, I do this work as well, to transform their bottom lines in terms of actually having the right people within the organization and how they can become a better business, I guess. So I'm sure there's loads more to you. I know there is, because I had a look on your website as well, and I thought, God, I'll be doing the intro for the whole hour. Welcome, Rob. It's an absolute pleasure to meet you.
Thank you for having me. I know we're kindred spirits, so that's exciting.
Definitely, definitely. So, as always, I'm intrigued with lots of things on your bio, but I'm intrigued to know what drove you as a younger man. Obviously, you were very successful quite early. What drove you to get to that point? And then, of course, that whole life-changing moment of the 5 days in the blizzard. Obviously, that speaks for itself in a lot of ways. But yeah, I'd love to hear some of your backstory and really what drives you as an individual and how that's changed.
Well, I was very lucky when I was in high school. I knew what I wanted to do. You know, most kids, it's certainly in America, they go on to a liberal arts college and they change their major two or three times along the way. And when I was about 15, I started mountain climbing and hiking, and I live in Colorado, gorgeous place. Mm. And the cameras in those days were these little point and shoot cameras that took terrible pictures. So I was seeing these dramatic, beautiful mountain scenes that I wanted to share with people. And I would take these pictures and they would be terrible. And so I got into photography. And then by the time I was ready to graduate high school, I knew I wanted to go into photography. So when all my friends went off to liberal arts colleges, I went directly to one of the premier photography schools in America. And I migrated from still photography into films. And I loved communicating with people, telling people, showing people the miraculous places I was seeing in the mountains. And then that turned into telling other kinds of stories as well. So I was very lucky to get on with ABC television when I was very young and doing the kinds of films that I wanted to do. So I got to go to the Himalayas and climb big mountains next to Mount Everest. And I was a kayaker. I got to make kayak films on unexplored rivers all over the world. So I was very lucky. I was very intentional, but I also realized there was a good bit of luck there, that I was able to combine all the things that I loved and make a living doing it. And I just didn't settle for any other way of doing it. I knew what I wanted and I went after it.
How did you get that break? You know, how did you actually get that job?
Well, I mean, I applied and I had good credentials. I was a good mountaineer. I was a competent kayaker. I was a good outdoors person. And I had a very good film education. And a lot of the guys doing that, they were all much older than me, but a lot of them didn't have the kind of classical or technical background of going to a film school. They picked up a camera and they were outdoor adventurers, and then they kind of combined their things. So I had a lot of good credentials. And, you know, then when you got on the job, you had to pull your weight. And I was much younger than all of them, but I was able to, you know, create a career doing that. And then when I met the woman that would become my wife, I convinced her to join with me. She was a construction superintendent building big condominium projects. And I said, you know, the skill set for producing a condominium and producing a film are the same skill set, multitasking and keeping a bunch of balls in the air at the same time and being really good with people. So she joined me. And then we continued to do that same thing. We continued to make the kinds of films we wanted to make. And that's a lot of that not settling. And I think it starts with giving yourself permission to have the kind of life you want. Mm. Telling yourself that not only can you have that, but you deserve to have that. And so, you know, I could have made boring films in the studio, but that's not what I wanted to do. So I figured out how to combine all the things I love to do and make a good living doing it.
You know, certainly that young age, you had what sounds like crystal clear vision of the ultimate really for you at that time. Where did that come from? Because a lot of people will suffer with, you know, self-doubt, don't deserve it, whatever the doubts are or the fears that come into play to stop people doing these things. What do you think it was for you? Was it your upbringing or?
I think it probably was. You know, it's hard to say. I mean, my parents wanted me, my dad was a doctor. They wanted me to go into a much more traditional kind of be a doctor or a lawyer, or every one of their friends was a doctor, a lawyer, or a businessman. And this idea of going into the arts was very foreign to them. They were not in favor of it. Luckily, I had some teachers at school that convinced me that not only could I do it, but the door was open to do it. And so that my teachers were very instrumental in helping me see an alternative path and going out of their way to open some doors for me in that sense so that I could see myself in that role. So that was a big part of it.
Well, that's amazing because a lot of teachers aren't like that. So, you were blessed to have those that saw beyond, the norm, I guess.
Well, I graduated high school 50 years ago, and one of my teachers is still one of my very close friends.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah, I've stayed in touch with several of my teachers. The specific teachers who were that kind of inspiration to me are still my good friends.
That's amazing. And not many people can say that either.
Yes, they add a great dimension to my life.
Wow. Okay. So you convinced your wife to travel the world with you while you made films that you wanted to make. How long did you do all of that for?
I was in business making movies for 20 years, and I loved it for 19 and a half of those years. And when I stopped loving it, I stopped doing it. And that's really the crux of it, because very few people would make that decision. I was 42 years old in the prime of my earning years. You know, in the film business, it takes you a long time to get established, to get credentials, to get a good reel of work you've done to help you get the next job. And so I was at the peak of my career, and I just didn't love making movies anymore. And so we closed our company and did something different. And that's certainly a decision most people would not have made. They would go with the comfort zone and the stay in their comfort level and continue to do something that didn't spark them. So that's one of the things that I would say that made me different. And it comes from demanding more of myself and demanding more of life. I just expect more out of life than some people, and I expect to work harder, and you know, so I'm not easy on myself in seeking my goals.
When you decided to close and you'd felt fallen out of love with it, was that before or after the accident?
Well, with it wasn't an accident,
Not an
and
accident. Sorry, you got lost, I
it
know, but.
this surviving in the wilderness, and I talk about that this in the talks that I do, it sounds incredibly dramatic, and it was very dramatic, but not really for us. It was dramatic for all of our family and friends, but we never questioned the outcome. I live in a space of a happy life, and I do all these things to make myself happy. That's kind of my driving motivation for, I think our purpose in life is to make ourselves happy and make other people happy. And so that's how I lived. So we survived out in the wilderness, but it was not a particularly life-changing moment for us. You know, so many people that do the kinds of speaking and coaching that you and I do, they have this dramatic story of, you know, getting cancer and seeing the light and changing their life. And for us, it really wasn't that way. It was dramatic in a different sense, but it was mostly I would say a proof of the resilience and the optimism that we had out there because of the way we have decided to live a happy life. And you know, I tell a story in my talks where after we came back from the wilderness and we got out, and then the third day out of the hospital, the doctors told me that they were going to amputate both of my wife's feet, and then a couple days later they would amputate her fingers. And I went home, you know, in shock from that, and I don't remember what else they said or driving home. And I walked in the door, and as I opened the door, I looked down and I saw a pair of my wife's running shoes where she had taken them off by the door there. And my legs just turned to dust and I collapsed on the floor. And I lay there all night long, just crying uncontrollably. And, you know, every time if I would open my eyes, I would see these running shoes again a couple feet from where I was laying, and these shoes that she would never wear again in her life. And I spent the whole night just crying uncontrollably, trying to imagine what kind of future awaited us with this terrible, diagnosis, this thing hanging over our head. And it was the most powerless moment of my entire life, laying there on the floor with nothing I could do about what was about to happen to her. But I woke up completely transformed, feeling as powerful as I had ever felt in my life. And I raced to the hospital before the doctors could talk with her. And I said, "You're going to have a complete recovery." And we both started focusing only on having a complete recovery. And from that moment on, we started talking about all the other great things we were going to do in our lives. And what happened in that those little hours between when I felt the most powerless and then the most powerful in my life is sometime around 4 or 5 in the morning, I must have finally fallen asleep, and my subconscious mind took over, and it did exactly what it had been doing my whole life. It decided to be happy. So I decided to be happy, not happy if my wife recovered or happy when she recovered. I just decided to be happy. And so I made that decision subconsciously, and then I acted on it, and I went to the hospital, and then I told her she would have the recovery. When the doctors came in about an hour later to prep her for the surgery, we refused to sign the papers authorizing the amputations. And the threat of amputation hung over our head for almost a whole year, months and months and months of recovery. And all that time, we only focused on our compelling future and on being happy, not when she got better, but being happy right now.
So it sounds to me like your wife's very similar to you in terms of the positive outlook. So as soon as you said that to her, she was like, "Yes, I'm with you." You know, she wasn't like, "Well, the doctors know best" and all of that. She just was like, "Yeah."
Well, she hadn't actually heard the diagnosis.
Right, okay.
So they had pulled me out of her hospital room at the end of that third day back and told me, but they hadn't told her yet. And so I kind of preempted that by just telling her, "You're going to have a complete recovery." Totally focused on that. When the doctors came in a little while later, she's like looking at me, "What are they talking about?" And there were multiple different doctors taking care of her. One of them was the surgeon and one was the trying to heal her feet. And, so the second doctor came in and we had the same kind of conversation. And then the hospital sent a psychiatrist in to talk to us because clearly we were in denial.
Yeah, clearly you're crazy, yeah.
And we had the same conversation with him. But eventually we came to a bit of a standoff with an agreement with the doctors. And they certainly did. What they did cured her feet. I mean, they treated her in a specific way and they saved her. But had we let them, they would have cut them off before that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I've never been a big Western medicine fan. I've always gone towards the Eastern philosophies. I'm a Reiki healer as well. And it boggles my brain that the answer to everything is chop it off, because it is.
Well, I won't disagree with you, but I will tell you, I come from a medical background. My father was a physician. My first jobs after I graduated from being a paper boy, my first jobs when I was a teenager and in high school were working in the hospital. I worked as an orderly in the hospital. I'm not a particularly bought into Eastern medicine or that sort of thing. So I'm very much in the camp of listening to the doctors, but this was just something different. And one of the things that happened, Tony Robbins had been our mentor and we had some personal relationships with him. And he called Dee in the hospital and he talked with her. And one of the things we told the doctor, I guess maybe the psychiatrist, when he was actually listening to us, we said, "Well, we've done Tony Robbins firewalks. I don't know how that works, but I know we did it. And so I don't know how she's going to get healed, but I believe she, we can do this." And Tony called her in the hospital, and then Tony sent her some tapes of, this was in the cassette tape era, of Deepak Chopra, Tony's friend Deepak Chopra, and she listened to these Deepak Chopra tapes every day, multiple times a day, working on rebuilding her, visualizing rebuilding the cells in her feet that were so damaged, and eventually we did.
Have you, do you know Dr. Joe Dispenza?
I do know Dr. Dispenza. This gets into another story, but at another point in our lives, my wife had a severe closed head injury. She was walking in the crosswalk and got hit by a truck. And the kid who was next to her on the street said when her head hit the pavement, it sounded like a gunshot going off.
Wow.
And so I actually had quite a few personal conversations with Dr. Dispenza right after that happened, as and I think it was when he was just writing his first book. So anyway, we did, yes, I am familiar with him, and we talked with him, and anyway, she overcame that as well.
Wow, amazing. Yeah, because that's what I was thinking of. I've discovered Dr. Joe about, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, something like that, and Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself is one of my favorite books because he just makes it so easy to understand, and he bridges the science and the mysticism, right? So, okay, amazing. Just going back though, how did you get stuck for 5 days? Was it like you were out hiking and all of a sudden this blizzard came, or?
Yeah, we were on our way to a backcountry cabin, cross-country skiing, and this was in 1993. The weather reporting was nothing like it is today. And this huge storm blew into Colorado, unforecast, and it turned into a total whiteout. And it actually became one of the biggest storms in Colorado history. It caused avalanches all over the state. It trapped people in their cars. It trapped people at the ski areas. And so the national news media was focusing on all this unprecedented storm in Colorado. And then when they heard about the lost skiers, the story went completely viral. And, you know, people get lost in the wilderness all the time in Colorado, and they rarely last, if it's a winter time, a day, maybe two at the most. And so for 5 days while they were looking for us, we were out there. And it turned into a whiteout, so we couldn't find the cabin, and we didn't have tents with us. So I was a very experienced mountaineer. I'd climbed in Alaska and in the Himalayas. So I had a lot of the technical skills to survive myself, but we had a whole group of people and some weak links in there, and so it was a different kind of experience. And, you know, on day three, the sheriff announced that the chances of our survival were only 10%. And then on day four, he came out and said the avalanche conditions were too severe, and they were sending live rescuers after our dead bodies. And then on day five, he said they were calling off the search and they would recover our frozen bodies in the springtime. And that was the same day that we ended up getting out. That fifth day, we finally made contact with the rescuers. And we were basically healthy, but my wife had this severe frostbite, and we had spent, you know, it was pretty miserable being out there for going those endless nights with no protection and that sort of thing. But because I've always lived this life of, I've always made this decision that I'm going to be happy, just like I did in that critical moment that I described. And so sort of the byproducts of living this life of being happy are resilience and optimism. And so when we were out there, we were optimistic, we were still healthy, we were still skiing, breaking trail, trying to get out, and we just never considered any other alternative. There was never going to be any other outcome other than that we were going to get out. And we had a woman with us that our group got a little separated, but we were with one woman, and she did not have that same outlook. On the second day, she wanted to lay down in the snow and die.
Oh, wow.
And she actually just shrugged her pack off her shoulders. I was in front breaking trail, and she was behind me. And at one point, she just shrugged her pack off her shoulders and kept going without it. And so now she had no sleeping bag.
All right.
So then when we got to the end of that day and she was still moving, she freaked out about not having a sleeping bag. My wife gave her sleeping bag to this other woman, And my wife and I tried to use my one bag as kind of a little cover for the two of us. But her attitude was completely different. And we did manage, I did, it took every bit of Tony Robbins' NLP training that I had to continue to motivate her for the next 3 days to keep moving. But we did get her out alive as well.
Wow. Whew. That must have been quite intense.
It really wasn't. It's hard for me to describe this because it was a very dramatic episode. But at the exact moment on that fifth day when the sheriff went on television and did a press conference and said, we're closing it down the search and we will recover their frozen bodies when the springtime comes. Literally at the exact moment he was saying that on television, my wife and I were having a discussion as to how we were going to make up the lost time in our office on a project that we had due in a film editing job we had due in a few days. And so we were discussing this completely mundane thing while the rest of the world's perspective was that we were dead.
You were dead.
And so it was because we have this idea of optimism, and then we, and optimism and this living this happy life breeds resilience, and resilience is the antidote to burnout. And it doesn't matter if you're burned out from breaking trail through the deep snow for 5 days, or you're burned out from your office job, or you're burned out because your kids are struggling at school, or your home life, or your mortgage is due. Resilience is resilience. And so when people adopt these traits that I teach, when they first make the decision to be happy, and then they adopt these traits and habits that happy people do, they build that kind of optimism and resilience, and it changes every part of your life. And here's why it changes every part of your life. This may be the most important thing I can say during our whole podcast. The experience of our life is not what happens to us. It's how we think about what happens to us. So I'm going to say that one more time. The experience of our life is not what happens to us. It's how we think about what happens to us. And happy people think differently. So the experience of our life was we were in this miserable, terrible storm, freezing all night long. The temperature never got above zero. We shivered violently all night. But we were optimistic. And when we saw the first little glimmer of the sky getting a little lighter and we knew we'd made it through another night, we were grateful. And so we had optimism and resilience, and that's what allowed us to think differently about that situation. So while the entire world was thinking one thing about the situation, and I mean my brothers and my friends told me the dreams that are the imagination that they were having of us freezing to death out there, and we were having a completely different experience because we thought about it differently.
That's so powerful. It's not what happens to us. It's how we either react to what happens to us or how we think about what happens to us. And that's something I very often have a conversation with my other half about. He's a left brain logical engineer, and I'm the complete opposite to that. No logic here whatsoever, Rob. I'm becoming one of his greatest teachers because he's seeing life differently, you know, and he's realizing that that reaction, even if it's a completely, like you say, the thought is always worse than reality. The people that aren't experiencing it thought for all sorts of things, and that just wasn't even true. And that's what people do in their everyday life. Oh, I can't do that because I'll end up homeless and living under a bridge. Well, no, you won't. But, you know, that's like the worst case scenario. And it's amazing to hear that you had that resilience. And I'd like to think if I was in that situation, I'd be exactly, I haven't got your mountaineering training, but just the fact that you, when I went, "Ooh, that must have been whatever," I was thinking about having to keep that woman up that whole time. That must have been like, Jesus, come on, you know?
Well, it was everything. Sometimes I commiserated with her. Sometimes I cajoled her. Sometimes I yelled at her.
Yeah.
I did every different thing I could think of to, as Tony Robbins would say, interrupt her current pattern and get her into a new place. And it managed to work. One of the things, you know, we haven't really talked about it, but so a year after my it took a year for my wife to get healed, but a year after our ski trip, we were with Tony Robbins in Cancun at one of his as his guest at one of his programs, and she was dancing in the sand there with 2 feet and 10 fingers and 9.5 toes. And a year after that, we began to put into place this compelling future we had talked about that very first morning in the hospital and at other times since then. And so we sold our home and bought a sailboat, and we took off to go sailing in the Caribbean. And our plan was we were going to spend 3 or 4 years in the Caribbean and then come back to work. And what precipitated us leaving at that point, we had kind of had a 10-year plan in the back of our mind of going sailing, but it's what I said earlier. I had spent 19 and a half years in the film business loving it, and when I stopped loving it, that's when we put in place the plan to go sailing. So we took off to go sailing for 3 or 4 years. Life changed a little bit. We ended up spending 17 years out sailing around the world. And I have given a number of presentations when I first came back that were kind of travelogy about our sailing experiences and all of that. And I always try to give people more than just a travelogue, give them some of the life lessons we learned along the way. And the most important life lesson I probably learned was that as we were sailing, every time we got farther out of our comfort zone, we went a little farther afield, a little more remote place, we didn't have as good a charts, we didn't know what we were going to find. Every time we did that and got out of our comfort zone, the rewards were better and better. We had experiences with, you know, where we were the guests of honor at these Fijian feasts in a village that had never had any outsiders visited. They'd never had another sailboat call in their village.
Really? Wow.
And then we went to another village, and the guy said, oh, all the sailboats that come here sign my log. You have to sign the log and, you know, be our guest. And we went in, and I looked at the log, and there had been one other boat, and it was like 12 years earlier.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, we had these kinds of experiences that were amazing, but it was totally due to the fact that we got further and further from our comfort zone. And that's where all the magic of life lies, is just outside your comfort zone. But this amazing thing happens when, I know we're not on video, but people can imagine what I'm showing you. If you think of your comfort zone as this circle that is around you, and if you push it out 1 foot, say, to the north by trying one more new thing, it doesn't just get bigger by 1 foot to the north, it gets bigger by all 360 degrees. So you took a little tiny step, but your comfort zone expanded by pi r squared, basically, the area of the circle. And so that's really the key to having a fulfilling, extraordinary life, is being willing to get outside of your comfort zone.
Completely agree. We're not taught that in school, are we? You know, in terms of your upbringing, in terms of the conditioning and the upbringing of your parents, their grandparents, etc., etc. And it's all very much about keeping your head down, working hard, and not moaning, right? And life's changing. Life's definitely changing. And I think, like you say, the Great Resignation has brought in a lot of changes for a lot of people, and it's given a lot of new perspectives as well, which is now fueling this sort of work and fueling more people that want to do more with their life, which is amazing. The comfort zone, it's scary, but it's never as scary as you think it is. I remember
just
sharing one little thing with you. I went to the Dominican Republic. So I joined an online marketing company a few years ago to become, you know, to quit the job and be my own boss and all that sort of stuff. And we went to this retreat in the Dominican Republic, and I'm scared to death of deep water because I had an accident when I was a kid, and I've never got over that and never addressed it and never wanted to address it. So the deep water thing's always been a thing for me. We went out to this beautiful location. I can't remember what it was called, but it was like crystal blue, like almost in a open cave sort of thing. And everyone's like jumping into this thing, which we were told was so many hundred feet deep and blah, blah, blah. And I'm watching all this and I'm like, no chance. And And it was nobody else saying anything to me, but I'm just like watching all this fun. And I took my son as well, and he was having a great time. And I was like, it can't be that bad. Nobody's drowned, by the way. Everybody's fine. And so, yeah, I just talked myself into it. And I went to a guy who used to be a captain of a yacht. So I felt very safe with him and just said, I really want to jump in. I'm shit scared. Will you hold my hand and will you jump in with me? And it's on video, and you've got everybody just like cheering me on because I'm like petrified, but probably like, you know, when people walk across the fire at Tony Robbins or whatever. But I did it. And do you know what? I mean, I was scared. It wasn't as bad as I was expecting. And the result of afterwards, I felt elated. I felt like so proud of myself and realized, you know, all of those fears for all of those years and how much it's held me back. You know, it's incredible.
Absolutely. Well, good for you for jumping and doing that. That and it's in, you know, when people do every time, I've never heard anybody, literally, I coach people on how to break through fear. I've never, ever heard anybody do what you did, do the jump or whatever the thing is for them and regret it.
No.
Literally never. Zero.
No.
Every time people push the envelope and try something, they are so glad they did.
How did it go from 3 to 4 years of sailing around the Caribbean to 17? Did it just evolve that way?
Well, it evolved. It was a couple of different things. So people always wonder about the practical side of it. And financially, it happened to be the late 90s, which were very good in the stock market. So when we left, I had a nest egg that I figured was good for, say, 4 years of cruising, plus right. a little cushion for us to come back and get reestablished with jobs and doing what we were going to do. And the stock market was very good. I had learned a lot about investing also from Tony Robbins. And the living on the boat is fairly inexpensive. You've cut out so many of your monthly expenses. And so at the end of 4 years, our nest egg was actually bigger than when we had left.
Right. Wow.
So the longer we stayed out cruising, the more money we had in the bank. That's a pretty good outcome. And we were having every day, literally, we pinched ourselves at the end of every day saying, do you believe we're so lucky we get to live this lifestyle? And we did it for 4 years, and then we knew we could afford to keep going. So we went a couple more, and we ended up spending 7 years all in the Caribbean, all the different islands and along the Central American coast, like near the DR and that sort of thing. And then we decided to sail around the world. My wife was the one who really wanted to do that more. I was a little nervous about getting outside of my comfort zone. And it's as the captain of the boat, there's a huge amount of responsibility on me when we head across the ocean. And so, but we had spent 7 years in the Caribbean, and then we decided to circumnavigate the world. And that was a sort of a 10-year effort. And we lived in Thailand for 3 years and lived in Australia for a couple of years. And when there's just two of you on a sailboat, one of you needs to be on watch all the time as you sail across the ocean. So one person is on watch while the other person sleeps. And so you're on watch for 6 hours a day during the day, and then again 6 hours a night, day after day, night after night. And these watches add up to thousands and thousands of hours of meditation and contemplation. And the ocean you're meditating on is a bit like life. Sometimes it's calm and peaceful with puffy white clouds overhead, and other times it's a raging maelstrom. And these hours add up, and you're thinking about all these things of your life and reflecting and trying to figure out the life lessons you've learned along the way. And one of the things is that there's really nothing that can make you feel as insignificant as being on a small boat in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. You know, you're thousands of miles from any land or from any other human. And yet, as insignificant as you feel, you feel sort of connected to everything because the oceans connect everything. You know, you're bobbing there on your boat between the sea and the star-filled sky overhead, and you see every little glimmer of starlight up above you. It feels like you can feel the earth breathing with every wave that lifts your boat. And The oceans connect everything. You know, we had left from Florida. One of the places we wanted to go was Australia, clear on the other side of the planet. But the ocean and our boat and the wind could connect those two places for us. So I always became interested in this idea of connection. And as a filmmakers and storytellers and authors are always looking for what they call the red thread, or sometimes it's called the through line. And it's the red thread is the thread that weaves through an entire book or movie or story, and it ties all those pieces together. And so when we were out there on the ocean with these hours and hours to contemplate and think about things, I came to realize what my own personal red thread was. And for me, it was this idea that our purpose here is to be happy, to make ourselves happy, and help others find their own happiness. And so that's then became kind of a driving force for me for the rest of our 17 years, is making myself happy, figuring out what made me happy, and how I could share it and teach other people how to be happy.
Before we move on from that, this could be an inappropriate question, but I thought about it when you were talking about somebody's always got to be on watch on the boat. What happened to the love life?
Oh, it's fantastic. It's actually the well, I mean, you're together first. If you're sleeping for 6 or 8 hours a day, each of you, that's only half of the day. There's still plenty of time to be together. And one of the most common questions we get is, how did the two of you get along so well on a boat 24/7 in a 40-foot sailboat for years? And it for us, it made our lives better than ever. I mean, we do everything together. We rarely ever get on each other's nerves or anything like that. And our 40th wedding anniversary will be in a couple of months.
Oh, amazing. Ruby wedding. What are you doing for that?
We haven't talked about it yet. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to Burning Man just before our anniversary. And my wife, she's been with me several years, but she didn't want to go this year. So I have to rush back from Burning Man in time for our anniversary.
Right. Okay. Well, I hope you have a wonderful time. I'm sure you will. So basically, while you were out there reflecting, meditating, the inspiration came in terms of what your red thread was, and then you wanted to give that to the world. So what did that look like, in terms of when you came back on the boat and got back on into normal civvy land or whatever you want to call it?
Well, it's very much what you alluded to a few moments ago, actually. And I think there is this giant silver lining in the pandemic that millions of more people are now looking for a happy life. You know, and it's basically what you said a few minutes ago, that during the pandemic, people started examining their life and saying, why aren't I happy? Or first of all, am I happy? And then realizing, no, I'm not. And then wondering, why not? And so the fact that millions of people around the world are looking at these questions, I think is the silver lining. And I think it's going to lead to a better work experience for most people. And it's going to change companies that are focused on that. And those companies will be more profitable, because if your employees are happy, they generate more profit for your company. And so I think all of this is the silver lining in the pandemic. And that's what, in answer to your question about my life. So when we came back, I started speaking a little bit and doing some talks, not a lot. I was still retired and enjoying my life. And during the pandemic, the pandemic was very easy for my wife and I. We're financially secure. We didn't have any kids to homeschool. You know, we didn't worry about our job. We didn't have jobs to worry about. And we live in a beautiful place up in the mountains where we could go do the things we normally do anyway. But I was aware of how difficult it was for so many of my friends, the younger friends, you know, my friends that have kids and they're homeschooling two kids and their job just got cut. And it was just so stressful for so many people. And I was painfully aware of how easy it was for me. And I wouldn't say I felt guilty, but I felt a call to, I know how to be happy, and I know how to teach other people to be happy. So during the pandemic, I really felt a call to do that. And so I started this encore career in my late 60s of being a motivational speaker. And I go into businesses and I teach their employees the skills of happiness. Because there's two parts, scientists identify two different kinds of happiness. One of them is called hedonic happiness, which comes from the word hedonism. And it's the things that are pleasurable. So it's, you know, eating an ice cream cone or sex or buying a new car or, you know, meeting the right person or getting a raise at your job. It's all those things that do make us happy, but they make us happy for a really short period of time.
Yeah.
And that's what all the companies focus on. Mm. They focus on compensation and, you know, during the pandemic when they're losing jobs, great resignation. Well, we're going to add some benefits. You know, you get Taco Tuesdays and kombucha on tap, as if that's going to make a long-term difference in people's happiness levels. So businesses are very and even people, if you ask your employees what's going to make you happy, they're probably going to tell you some of those kinds of things, a raise, you know, a gym membership, whatever, these benefits, because that's all they know. But in fact, the things that really make us happy long-term and deep down are things that provide purpose and meaning.
Yeah.
And so those are the skills that we learned out sailing. You know, that you read that line in my bio about spending time with billionaires and barefoot villagers. And before we left, we were combining our filming with our sailing interest. And we were filming the America's Cup and some of these very high-end yacht races. And the people that do that are all billionaires and multimillionaires. And their crews sail the boat to the regatta and they fly in the private jet. And then we would get to go out with them on their boat and film. And we found out that these billionaires were, like, some of them were happy and some weren't. And then a few years later, we were with these barefoot villagers and living in grass shacks in third world countries. And some of them were happy and some weren't. And the percentage wasn't that different than the billionaires. So the billionaires could afford to indulge their hedonic happiness to whatever level they wanted. They could buy whatever and do whatever. And they weren't all that happy. But we were also part of another group, and that was this group of sailors just like us, because the sailing community is very cohesive. You're all going the same place with the trade winds. You're all going away from the hurricane zone during certain months of the year. So you're kind of part of this loose migrating group.
Right.
And all the sailors out there, this was before the era of the digital nomad. Nobody was out there working. We had all just made the same decision. We had all made a decision to go be happy, and we were doing things every day that made us happy. Mm. Nobody was out there trying to race from point A to B. Nobody was building a business. We were just, the goal was to be happy. And this group, almost everybody was happy.
Mm.
So unlike the billionaires and the barefoot villagers that were 50-50, 60-40, whatever, this group of sailors, almost everybody was happy. And so I was studying this red thread of mine, this idea, and I had time to observe this huge group that almost all of them were happy and almost all of them were doing the same things. And they were doing these things that provide meaning and purpose in our lives. Because when you get on a sailboat, you don't have room for a lot of stuff. We moved from a 2,800 square foot house to a 300 square foot sailboat. You can't carry all your things, that hedonic things that make you happy. You don't have room for your espresso maker and whatever else. And you're living kind of being on a boat in a storm is not a picnic. It's a rough life.
Oh yeah.
We had foregone all of those things that most people think make them happy. And instead, we were looking for these things that provide meaning and purpose in our lives. And we were finding them. And this whole group was happy. So those are the kinds of things that I teach in my program now, to help people find that kind of happiness that comes from purpose and meaning in our lives.
And do you work with anyone, or have you got is it mainly men, women, or women? Is it mainly older, younger, or is it just anyone?
Well, it's anyone. I mean, I'm doing a next week here in the city that I live in the Salida. I'm doing a 1-day workshop for free, actually, for people in the community. And that's for anyone. Primarily what I do is I go to businesses who are struggling with the Great Resignation, and I do either keynote speeches or one-day workshops where we do a real deep dive into here's the things that give meaning and purpose in your life. Here's how you can adopt them, make them part of your life. And I do things like you talked about your experience with the water. I do things on how to invent a new story for yourself. So we all have some trauma from our past, and I have a process that I take people through to rewrite their story so that they learn the lesson but leave the pain behind, and so they can go forward. And if people, I sort of have a disclaimer. I mean, it's not for people that have real serious trauma. I'm not a mental health professional, but we all have some kind of thing in our past that's preventing us from getting to our future. Something that we tell, some story we tell ourselves. So I do, we work through that. Then we work through things like gratitude and contribution and things that give our life meaning. And I talk about how these insights came to us with through sailing. So I tell stories of this happened while we were out sailing. So it's an impactful story. And here's the lesson we learned from it, that kind of thing. And as I said, I think that's the silver lining in the pandemic is that more and more people are looking for that. So these companies that are struggling with resignations, they don't know why their employees are leaving. And they companies do engagement surveys of their employees. And the typical engagement survey, every question on the engagement survey is some version of how can we make you happier at work? What can we do to make you more fulfilled at work? What can we make you do so you like your job better at work? And if you listen to people that resigned during the pandemic, they all said, I was burned out with life. Not my work, but with my life. So if you're a business owner and you're only focusing on some hedonic happiness that's going to affect them 9 to 5, you are not going to be successful in making them happy and keeping them on the job. If you focus on making their whole life better by teaching them how to look at the world with an optimistic viewpoint and building that resilience in so they don't get burned out and helping them find ways that they can live in gratitude and contribution, people will have better lives and then they won't be looking to change jobs because they'll be getting meaning from the life that they're currently living. So that's what I do. I go into corporations and I do that kind of training.
And how do you find these companies that are suffering, you know, with the great resignation and they're suffering with the staff? Because I'm, as I said to you at the beginning, I'm in a very similar space in as much as coming at it from a slightly different angle. So for us, it's organizations where that small to medium business has grown, the leadership has grown or it's changed or whatever. And there's a different set of values, you know, within each individual that sits at the top of the tree. And there could be arguments, there could be different agendas, there could be all of these things. And because of that confusion and that conflict potentially, then the employees don't know what the values and the vision, the true vision is of the business, and therefore neither do the clients. And so they're not wedded to the vision or the mission, you know, and they're not aligned. So we very much work on the values and the vision and the mission from the top down. And once you get those foundations right, you probably will have some fallout because some staff are not going to relate or you know, be aligned to this new vision. And but the vision is actually coming from the right place now, that you know, the values are aligned to all of the leaders as well as the actual business itself. So we work on the same thing in as much as if you want to reduce your staff attrition, then you've got to get the foundations right. And then, you know, some organizations will then put their employees through the program as well. To so they can understand what their values and vision and mission is for the world, not just for work, obviously. So it's a very similar thing, but you're coming at it from a holistic happiness, content, what you know, looking at life differently. We're looking at it a little bit more specific in terms of values, vision, and mission. How do you find these companies that are suffering in terms of the great resignation? Are they approaching you?
Oh, it's both. And I completely agree with your mission. I have friends that do that same thing in the United States that focus on values. And you're right, it has to come from the top down and it has to go spread out to the employees and to the customer base. And I read a number a study recently that said 76% of younger people, and it didn't define younger people, but it said 76% of younger workers would take a pay cut to work at a company whose mission aligned with their own values. But
Absolutely.
that's gigantic. And that's totally the opposite of these companies that think I can keep my employee if I give them Taco Tuesdays and, a gym membership or whatever. So that's what you do is so important. It's different than what I do, but it has the same end result. It makes the business aligned and the alignment all the way down the chain. I guess, I a couple days ago I got a call from somebody. I don't even know how they found me. I dropped the ball on my marketing. I should have asked them, and I will in my future conversations. But they're doing monthly webinars for their employees. They said they had about 80 employees, and for their customers, and they're just doing monthly webinars that they think will help people make their lives better, any kind of self-improvement. So they wanted me to do a keynote for that. I speak at HR conferences, so I'm speaking at well, I spoke at one a few weeks ago, and I've got two or three coming up, and like the state of Arizona, they're SHRM, which is the Society for Human Resources Management. So it's the Association of HR People. And I'll be speaking at their conference. And hopefully, out of that, I'm doing a keynote on some of the stuff we've talked about and why it's important to be, make your employees happy. And I give the numbers of how it's profitable to them and info for them to get the CEO to buy into this kind of training. And then hopefully out of that, speaking to the HR groups, their individual companies will bring me in to talk to do a full day workshop. 'Cause that's where the keynotes are great. It's nice to inspire people, but I really like doing the full day workshop 'cause I know when I leave, they've got tools to make themselves happier and they will be happier. And I make that transformation. So that's kind of what I enjoy doing.
Amazing. So if anybody listening really wants to know more about you or is interested in working with you in some capacity, where's the best place for them to find you?
They can find me on my website. It's just my name, Rob Dubin, RobDubin.com. And there's if your listeners are interested in some of the things we've talked about, the framework for happiness, or I think there's some things on relationships, some just the things that work for my wife and I, because we get that question so often, and some financial things, how we afforded to retire young. There's that, and there's some other resources, and those are all on the frequently asked questions page. If people want to fill out the form, they can select several different things to download.
Okay, cool. And I love to finish with anything you feel inspired to share as we finish this conversation.
Yes, I think that you are entitled to your to be happy, and you should be giving yourself permission to be happy. And I still do. I have a something I like to share. It's kind, maybe it's a memory that we might all share in common. And even if you don't share the memory, you probably can imagine the moment in your imagination. And I always remember when I was about 10 years old and I woke up on the very first morning of summer vacation, and you have the whole summer before you. You haven't a care in the world, and you have a million dreams and wishes and things you're going to do all summer, and you know you're going to make all of them come true. Well, my secret is that I still wake up that way every single morning. And you can too. When you wake up tomorrow morning, find that 10-year-old you that you were that knows that everything is possible and that what you're going to do that day is going to be fun and make yourself happy, and then find out a way to make others happy.
Amazing. Love that. Love that. Well, Rob, it's been a delight, a pleasure, awe-inspiring to have this hour with you. I know the listeners are going to love your story. I loved your story. You are an inspiration, and fair play to you. I mean, maybe you took sort of 17 years out and now you're feeling like you want to give back and your late 60s and all the rest of it, but actually it's what lights you up, isn't it? And I guess it doesn't probably feel like work to you anyway. This is you having an impact and improving and helping people's lives, you know, so amazing.
Absolutely. I have a friend who just last week, she teaches people how to find their purpose. And she said something that's one of the most beautiful quotes I've ever heard. Your purpose is the best of what you have to help others.
Oh, nice. Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Rob. It's been a delight. And I wish you all the best, especially for your Ruby wedding anniversary.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed that conversation or were inspired in any way, please, please leave me a review on iTunes. It's the best way for other people to find my podcast and be inspired themselves. Well, I really hope you enjoyed today's episode and perhaps the story resonated with your own life or reminded you that perhaps you're also settling for second best. I've been helping people from a young age and realising that there is more to life than what they are currently settling for. My desire is to give others the love to confidently and respectfully know their value so that they feel joy and are empowered to make a fulfilling difference. If that sounds good to you and you'd like to reach out and connect, you can find me at facebook.com/Mel Clark Coaching, that's Clark with an E, or instagram.com/Mel Clark Coaching. Enjoy your day.